Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mesner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Amanda, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, highlights from the 2015 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting. And this is a two-part series, so this is part one, and we have seven expert speakers on this program today who are really going to be sharing all of this information with everyone on the call today. We have had a wonderful response to this program. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and because of the collaboration and all of your interest in the program, we have on the call today over 1,658 participants from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Algeria, Argentina, Canada, India, Italy, Mexico, New Zealand, South Korea, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you have chosen to spend this next hour with us. This is actually next hour and a half with us. This call is going to run from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time today. Now, today's program has been supported by Novartis Oncology, Takeda Oncology, Astellas US LLC, Gilead, a grant from Genentech, a contribution from Lilly, and an unrestricted educational grant from Insight. And I really want to thank all of these corporations for their support of the program today and for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to begin by introducing our very first speaker, Dr. Edith Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is Clinical Professor of Medicine and Medical Oncology, Program Leader, Gastrointestinal Oncology, Department of Medical Oncology, Director, Center to Eliminate Cancer Disparities, Associate Director, Diversity Affairs, Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. And Dr. Mitchell is going to address clinical trials, and I'm now going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mitchell.
Dr. Mesner, thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with such a great and illustrious panel of speakers today, and to our audience that is listening in. We are so pleased to have all of you with us today. So our talks all today will focus on the American Society of Clinical Oncology and the recent meeting that was just concluded in Chicago. This was the 51st annual meeting of ASCO. And just last year, we had the opportunity to vote, and the physicians who are members of ASCO voted on the top five advances made over this 50-year period. And it was really a good time for us to review and think about cancer care 50 years ago. The American Cancer Society has recently published information demonstrating that there was a 22% improvement in overall survival of cancer patients in the United States. There was a 22% decline in cancer deaths. So what we can say is that there has been tremendous improvement in the overall cancer survival of patients, and fewer patients are dying of cancer in the United States. So this is great news from our societies. Now, when we think about what ASCO published last year at our 50th anniversary, indicating the top five advances in medical, in modern oncology over the last 50 years, what we can focus on, there are certainly five areas that have shown the top advances. While advances have occurred in many different disease processes and other conditions, these were the top five. Number one was curing Hodgkin's disease. When you think about 50 years ago, many patients with Hodgkin's disease died within the first year, and very few were cured. Now, more than 90% of patients with Hodgkin's disease can be cured on the first treatment program. And other disease processes included a vaccine to prevent cervical cancer, which has made tremendous strides and, of course, decreased the actual incidence as well as death rates from cervical cancer. A targeted drug that transforms treatment for a very rare leukemia. Again, with this leukemia, in previous years, it was universally fatal, whereas now almost every patient is cured. And not only has this drug been beneficial for the treatment of a rare form of leukemia, but other diseases also respond to this drug. Number four was treatment of men with testicular cancer. Previously, men with testicular cancer almost always died within the first year. Now what we can say is more than 90% will be totally cured of testicular cancer with their first treatment. And then the fifth was the treatment of nausea, vomiting, and other side effects of cancer treatment. Prior to the development of some very important drugs, patients suffered from cancer treatment tremendously, and nausea, vomiting was actually the most feared consequence of cancer treatment. All of these treatments, every single one that I've just mentioned as the top five, and those that did not make it to the top five, were all accomplished through clinical trials. So clinical trials has served as a springboard for all of the new treatments, all of these survival benefit that we're seeing now. So participating in clinical trials is a very important process for cancer treatment. All of the drugs, all of the processes that we have available now came about through clinical trials, and many of these trials were conducted through ASCO. And you ask yourself, why participate in a clinical trial? Well, participating in a clinical trial has many opportunities for patients, including getting and reaping the potential benefit of a new drug or a new combination or some other treatment, including radiation and others, in early treatment, and therefore being the first part of new developments in cancer treatment. So it's very important. There can be some side effects, but understand that cancer treatment itself can have some side effects, so these should be discussed with your doctors. Now, regarding the year of the meeting that was held this year, there were tremendous presentations on many processes and therefore very important. Therefore, it's important for us to understand, and you will hear from my colleagues on the various areas and the various cancer types where there were important new developments and new treatments, new results, and those results were the outcomes of clinical trials. One of the areas of focus this year was on precision cancer medicine. And by precision cancer medicine, it is trying to define which medication might be best for a given individual patient. And for the individual patient, therefore, this means that the medication or the treatment process will be more specific and more designed for individual treatment. One of the protocols that was outlined and presented at this meeting that is just and the protocol is just beginning, and that is of the MATCH, it's M-A-T-C-H program from the National Cancer Institute. This is a new trial, and it's a new kind of trial where the patient's tumor will first be tested to see what kind of modification or a mutation might be expressed in the cancer, and then medications that might target just that alteration. So this is a new area for clinical trials, and you'll hear more about this year. You'll hear more about the results of some important trials that have been conducted in many tumor types and many disease processes from my colleagues who will speak with you this afternoon after I finish. So as an introduction, we want to summarize and say that clinical trials are very important. They are important to the important advances that have been achieved in the treatment of cancer and have related to and provided patients in this country with a 22% decline in cancer death rates. So if we are to progress further, we must progress through clinical trials, and it is our privilege to present to you this afternoon some of the outcomes that were discussed at the last meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Dr. Messner, I thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with the group this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell. That was really wonderful, and what a wonderful beginning for this program, what a wonderful overview of clinical trials and the meaning of ASCO and all the research has been done. So thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Julie Grelo. Dr. Grelo is Professor of Medical Oncology, Jill Bennett Endowed Professorship in Breast Cancer, University of Washington School of Medicine, Director, Breast Medical Oncology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Grelo is going to present updates from ASCO on breast cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Grelo.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and good morning or afternoon or evening, depending on where you are in the world. My job is to talk about some of the key abstracts in breast cancer. I've picked the ones that might have more implications for practice now as opposed to research that might lead to something that comes into the clinic in the future. So I'm going to start with one abstract on a type of breast cancer that we call stage zero or DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ. This is a pre-invasive breast cancer, and it represents about 15% of the breast cancers that are diagnosed in the United States, mostly found by screening mammogram because we don't generally feel it on exam. We saw the reporting of a trial called the NSABP B35 trial. This was a trial of 3,000 postmenopausal women who had been diagnosed with ductal carcinoma in situ. They underwent a lumpectomy and radiation was planned. Now, previously we've seen that adding tamoxifen in this group can decrease recurrences after DCIS. So this trial was evaluating whether one of the aromatase inhibitors, anastrozole or arimidex, might be better than tamoxifen for patients who had DCIS. Of course, because ductal carcinoma in situ isn't invasive and it can't spread, there was no thought that we would be improving survival. So tamoxifen and anastrozole would be considered as options for following a surgery in DCIS. So what this trial did was it reported data after 10 years of follow-up. Half the women got 5 years of Arimidex and half got 5 years of tamoxifen. And they looked at something called the breast cancer-free interval. How many people were alive and without any breast cancer event? And they found that the Arimidex arm was slightly better. There was about a 4% absolute improvement in not having another breast cancer or recurrence in either breast during that 10-year period for getting the Arimidex. And the benefit seemed to be mostly in postmenopausal women who were less than 60, interestingly. I don't have an answer for why that would be. There were more cancers of the uterus and more blood clots in the group that got tamoxifen, and there were more fractures in the group that got an aromatase inhibitor. There were almost the same number of events in the breasts that had already had the DCIS and the opposite breasts. So I think what this was telling us was that these drugs are really acting as chemo prevention drugs in this setting. And I do think that the anastrozole or the Arimidex looked quite favorable, and that if you're thinking about drug therapy, which is a careful weighing of risks and benefits for a diagnosis of DCIS, anastrozole is probably the preferred option based on the side effect profile and the slight increase in benefits in not having a recurrence. Let's move into invasive breast cancer. We have estrogen receptor positive breast cancer I'm going to talk about first and just highlight one abstract. And there was a very important abstract that I think will immediately offer changes to practice called the Paloma 3 trial. This was a trial of a drug called palbociclib, or Ibrance is its trade name. It just got approved in February for metastatic estrogen receptor positive breast cancer patients at the first treatment. So the first time that they're getting any treatment after their metastatic diagnosis, patients were previously in a prior trial randomized to an aromatase inhibitor with or without this drug, palbociclib, and it was shown that they did better if they got the palbociclib. So the Paloma 3 trial was a trial for patients who had already had prior endocrine treatment, anti-estrogen treatment for metastatic breast cancer, and now they had had progression. And this trial, Paloma 3, gave everybody an endocrine agent called fulvestrant or Faslodex. It's a monthly shot, intramuscular shot. And then some of the women in the trial were randomized to get a placebo that they took daily, 3 out of 4 weeks, and the rest of the women were randomized to get this palbociclib drug, this cell cycle inhibitor drug, again, orally, daily, 3 out of 4 weeks. And what we saw reported at ASCO was that for the primary endpoint of the study, which is what we call progression-free survival, being alive without the disease progressing, the addition of palbociclib added an extra 5 months of not progressing, which is pretty impressive, not good enough. I hear all of you dealing with metastatic disease. It needs to be a lot longer, but 5 months difference between the group that just got fulvestrant and the group that had the combination. Side effects from the palbociclib or the Ibrance drug are really mostly in the blood counts, with white cells being low, and they have to be followed. And there was a little bit more anemia and low platelets and fatigue and infection, but those were really pretty minor. So now we have the potential, if we can get insurance to approve it, and I think we'll soon have the FDA rule on this as well, so that we will have a better chance of getting insurance approval, we can consider adding palbociclib to fulvestrant after progression for ER-positive metastatic disease. I've got two abstracts in the HER2-positive category I wanted to highlight. For those of you with HER2-positive disease, you may know that we have 4 FDA-approved drugs for HER2-positive breast cancer, and those drugs include trastuzumab or Herceptin, pertuzumab, lapatinib, or T-DM1. So the first study I wanted to highlight is the MARIANNE trial. This was a trial for metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer patients who didn't have any prior treatment for their metastatic recurrence. And the standard of care would be to give chemo. In this case, in the trial, you could get docetaxel, which is Taxotere, or paclitaxel, which is Taxol, along with trastuzumab, which is Herceptin. So that's the standard right now, to get some chemo and Herceptin. And there were 2 comparator arms to look at both toxicity and efficacy, how well the drug did treating cancer. So the first control arm was this antibody drug conjugate called T-DM1, or Kadcyla is its trade name. It is basically Herceptin with a linker to some chemo, the idea being that the Herceptin binds to the cancer cell, the chemo gets delivered inside, and the rest of the body doesn't see much of that chemo at all. And the third arm was the same TDM1 antibody with pertuzumab, which is a different antibody that binds to a different place on the HER2 molecule. And what the study showed was there was no difference between the three arms. So our current standard of care to give a taxane and Herceptin had the same outcome in terms of progression and how long patients lived as the newer drugs, and the combination was no better when we gave TDM1 with pertuzumab than just giving TDM1 alone. Interestingly, and this is important, the TDM1 had better tolerability, because the chemo doesn't get out to the rest of the body very much. So there was less neuropathy, diarrhea, less hair loss, but there was a little bit more liver toxicity and a little bit more decrease in the platelets. So overall, TDM1 is better tolerated than the combination of chemo and Herceptin. So look for this drug to be tested in earlier stage breast cancer and other places. The second HER2-positive trial was just a cool one. This isn't quite ready for prime time, but I liked it. It was looking at that TDM1, again, the antibody-drug conjugate, Herceptin, that's got chemo attached to it, in the preoperative setting for 12 weeks. So these were patients who had early-stage breast cancer that was HER2-positive, and one arm got 12 weeks of TDM1, and one arm got Herceptin, which is the antibody that there was no chemo given in this trial. And they could get endocrine therapy. There was some randomization there if they got an antiestrogen. And interestingly, so they gave 12 weeks, and then they went to surgery. And then they looked to see how many of the patients still had cancer left at the time of surgery after 12 weeks of treatment. In the TDM1 arms, there was a 40 to 45% chance that there was no cancer left anywhere in the breast or the lymph nodes. And for the group that just got the Herceptin antibody, there was only a 7% chance that there would be complete elimination of cancer. So I think that this TDM1 is very exciting because we don't probably have to give chemotherapy with it, and we saw excellent response rates in early stage breast cancer. This needs to be tested in much bigger studies, but it's very promising. The last abstract I'm going to highlight is in triple negative breast cancer. And triple negative breast cancer is about 18% of breast cancers in the U.S., and we define it by what it's not. We call it triple negative. It's not positive for estrogen receptor or progesterone receptor or HER2. And we work hard to figure out what is it? What is it positive for? This is a trial that tested for androgen receptor, so the male sex hormone receptor, androgen receptor in triple-negative breast cancer. And if I'm understanding correctly, I went back and tried to look at it, and it's somewhere between around two-thirds to three-quarters of the patients who had triple-negative breast cancer who were considered for this trial had testing for at least a little bit of androgen receptor, some with a whole bunch of androgen receptor on their cancer. And then they used a drug that we normally use to treat prostate cancer, enzalutamide. It's an anti-androgen. And this was not a randomization. They just wanted to see, can we get any benefit or any response? And indeed, they did. At 16 weeks, 35% of the patients had stable disease or a response. So that's a small study taking a first look at what might be a new strategy in at least a subset of triple-negative breast cancer. We clearly need to study this further, but I am starting to look in my triple-negative metastatic patients at whether their tumor expresses androgen receptor so I can look for a trial or the possibility of giving an antiestrogen. So there was a lot more that went on at ASCO in the area of breast cancer, but those were my top five abstracts. And if you want to read a little bit more detailed review of these and other abstracts, six of us wrote up some summaries of the breast abstracts, and they're published on the hashtag BCSM website. So that stands for Breast Cancer Social Media. So you can go to www.bcsmcommunity.org and look under the blogs, and you'll see summaries from six of us on what we thought the highlights were of breast cancer at ASCO. Thanks for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Grelow. That was really outstanding and just so amazing, the scope of the abstracts you chose to review and just the promise that they all offer. This is amazing. So thank you so much. And also thank you for that reference for everybody to actually be able to look and get some more information as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Executive Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Florida International University, Herbert Wertheim College of Medicine. And Dr. Runowitz, my esteemed colleague, is going to address ovarian cancer and updates from ASCO. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you for inviting me to summarize the GYN highlights focusing on ovarian cancer. I always enjoy the ASCO meeting as it gives me an opportunity to not only enhance my education and experience in gynecologic oncology, but also to see what my colleagues are doing in general. And I think this particular meeting, there was a general enthusiasm for the immunologic therapies in many cancers, although few of the studies and the presentations focus specifically on ovarian or other gynecologic cancers. I think this reflects the growing sentiment for what we call bucket trials, and those are therapies that are targeted at what we call the driver mutations rather than the organ of origin. And I think in the future, we will be focusing more on the individual mutations as opposed to where the organ of origin of the tumor is, which is really a shift in oncology. So to tell you a little bit about the immunologic studies, there was actually just one that I want to describe. And this was Desis and her colleagues reported on the anti-PD-1 antibody, and they have all similar names, avelumab, which targets the programmed DEF1 receptor ligand, or PD-1. This was a phase 1 study, which, as you know, is not a study designed to look at the effect, but to look at toxicity. However, it was a large study with 75 patients who'd been treated with a median of 4 prior treatments. The median duration of treatments was 10 weeks with a range of 2 to 54 weeks, and it demonstrated clinical activity. And again, in a phase 1 trial, that is not an endpoint. So if you see clinical activity, it's very exciting. And there was a good safety profile. There were 23 patients evaluable for response. The response rate was 17, partial response rate was 17% with a 48% stable disease. And that's an important observation, particularly in patients who have had 4 prior therapies. If you can stabilize disease, we consider that a success. And the progression-free survival was 12 weeks. And the expected adverse events were fatigue, nausea, and vomiting. And based on this trial, along with others, they recommended going on to a phase 2. So I'm very excited that we will see more immunologic studies in ovarian cancer, as we're seeing in lung and melanoma and other cancer presentations that were done this year at ASCO. Another big area in GYN were the PARP inhibitors. There were several posters and plenary sessions evaluating the activity and combinations of therapy. And just by way of background, the PARP inhibitors prevent the cancer cell from repairing, and so it goes into cell death, which is a good thing for a cancer cell. So there was a phase 2 multi-institutional study of rucaparib in BRCA mutation carriers with ovarian cancer and the related cancers of fallopian tube and primary peritoneal cancer. The patients, again, were heavily pretreated, 2 to 4 prior therapies with a median of 2 prior therapies. And what they reported was robust activity with a good response rate. So I would expect that we will see more studies of rucabarib in phase 3 trials. The next one, which is also rucabarib, was ARIEL 2 study, which is a multi-institutional phase 2 study using tumor genetic analysis to identify patients with ovarian cancer likely to respond to rucabarib. And I think that was a message that came through loud and clear in at least the GYN session, was these are expensive drugs, they're not for everybody, and how can we predict which patients will respond? So this particular ARIEL 2 study used a novel next-gen sequencing-based homologous recombination deficiency assay to predict sensitivity by assessing BRCA status and what was they looked for called a genome-wide loss of heterozygosity, or LOH. They enrolled platinum-sensitive, recurrent, high-grade ovarian cancer. The dose was 600 milligrams twice a day, and they identified three patient populations: those with known BRCA mutations, those that were BRCA-like, that is, they had a RAD51C mutation, and then the BRCA wild type, which is the normal, no BRCA mutation. And using this loss of heterozygosity screening technology, they could predict which patients were likely to respond, and they identified two particular groups: the BRCA mutation carriers, which is not surprising, and then the BRCA wild type with a high loss of heterozygosity. So that's very helpful in patients who may not have a BRCA mutation but have a tumor of what we call a BRCA-like, where it's behaving like a BRCA tumor but we can't identify the mutation. We now have another means to identify a responder. The next PARP inhibitor is olaparib, which is the drug that was released this year, Lynparza. And this particular group at the NCI, led by Dr. Chu et al., combined olaparib with carboplatin in a low genetic risk population with high-grade ovarian cancer. And the low genetic risk population would include patients without a BRCA mutation. And as many of the listeners know, the olaparib was approved for BRCA mutation carriers. So these kinds of studies may expand the indication. The median number of treatments in this group was very high. The median number was 7. They were platinum sensitive in 11 patients and platinum resistant in 19. So there were a lot of platinum resistant patients. What they reported was good activity with a partial response and a stable disease of 54%. Most of that activity was in platinum-sensitive patients. So this study established a phase 2 dose of olaparib, which will be 400 milligrams twice a day for the first 7 days, with a carboplatin of area under the curve of 4. So this is now a combination that has been tried in a phase 1 setting and will now go to a phase 2 dose. And the last PARP inhibitor that was reported was the olaparib in combination with Bev and chemotherapy as a phase 1. And this was the NRG, which is the cooperative group. We used to know it as the GOG. This was a 3-arm study. One arm was standard intravenous carbo-taxol. The second arm was carbo but weekly taxol. And the third arm was intraperitoneal. Bevacizumab was started in cycle 2, so they got both olaparib, a PARP inhibitor, and bevacizumab, and this is based on earlier studies that show improved effect with the combination. And what this phase 1 demonstrated was that this is a feasible combination with expected hematologic toxicity, and there was some activity demonstrated, so they will be going to a phase 2 study. So that was exciting, and the take-home message for the PARP inhibitor section was that these are active drugs, and we are learning to use them in combination. The next section is the biomarker identification for response. How do you individualize therapy? What is predictive for precision medicine? And there were two interesting trials, one with pertuzumab in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, and you just heard Julie talk about this in breast cancer. We've not really seen a lot of activity of the Herceptin, or the HER2 inhibitors. However, they looked at a marker which was a low HER3 mRNA expression, and that predicted response. So there may be, again, a way of predicting response to therapy. And then Mike Beer for the GOG looked at a predictive biomarker for first-line bevacizumab and identified high CD31 expression, which correlated with a better response, which makes sense as that's a pan-endothelial marker for the cell compartment targeted by Bev, and not surprisingly, VEGF-A expression correlated with response to bevacizumab. So we saw that there are going to be predictive precision markers to better identify patients and that we don't see ovarian cancer as one homogeneous cancer any longer. Then there were some new agents, AZD1775, which is a WEE1 protein kinase inhibitor. There was an international trial presented by OZA, which showed activity, a good response rate, and progression-free survival. So I believe that we will be seeing more studies examining this and drugs like this in ovarian cancer, particularly in P53 mutation, which is most of ovarian cancer. And then lastly, there was a folate receptor targeting phase 1 trial, which did show activity. There was an overall response rate of 40%, which was actually a little surprising as the folate receptor targeting trials to date, when they get to phase 3, have not shown activity as they've shown in the phase 1-2, and the discussant raised this issue. So we don't know if this antibody-drug conjugate is sufficiently different that it will give us the promise of folate receptors, because most ovarian cancers do have folate receptors. So that was pretty much the highlight of the meeting, that we were able to see some new immunologic studies, expand our knowledge in PARP inhibitors, and see some new agents. So thank you again for the opportunity to summarize the highlights of ASCO.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Ronowitz. That was beautifully done, really an exquisite presentation and really lots of detail for everybody to understand all of the advances in the treatment of ovarian cancer. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Louis Campbell. Dr. Campbell is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Cancers. And Dr. Campbell is going to present on updates in terms of prostate cancer and its treatment. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Campbell.
Thank you for allowing me to give you this rapid trip of 70 years of history of treating prostate cancer, and we do go back that far. As many of you know, it has been known since the 1940s that depriving cancer cells of testosterone results in improvement in symptoms and well-being in patients with advanced prostate cancer. Not much changed between the 1940s and the 1980s when drugs became available by injection that lower testosterone, obviating the need to remove the testicles surgically. And that, to this day, the use of testosterone-lowering agents remains the mainstay of treating advanced or unresectable or metastatic prostate cancer. Since the 1980s, as I just mentioned, there have been a number of agents that, by injection, lower testosterone. And at about the same time, we gained the use of agents that block testosterone from attaching to the cancer cells. Those are the antiandrogens. The first generations were drugs. First generation of these drugs were drugs like flutamide or nilutamide, and the one that became most commonly used for convenience was bicalutamide. through the 1980s, the 1990s, and the early 2000s, that was pretty much the treatment we had for metastatic or locally advanced unresectable prostate cancer. And it was about 2001 or 2002 that things began to change. The first big change was the approval of a drug called docetaxel, a chemotherapeutic agent that was shown in two trials to improve survival and was known to be superior to the prior chemotherapy drug that was used, which only affected quality of life, not survival, not size of tumors, and not PSA. So at that point, we had a new drug that we could use for patients who failed hormone therapy. The feeling was that patients who failed primary hormone therapy with an agent that lowers testosterone, and there are many different brands, Lupron, Zoladex, Trelstar, et cetera, and failed the addition of an antiandrogen like Casodex or bicalutamide, that the next step was chemotherapy. And the basis for that was that we understood at that time that once patients failed that primary hormone therapy, that their cells no longer needed testosterone and could grow without it. But in the late part of the first decade of 2000, 2006, 2007, 2008, several new agents were introduced into the care of patients with advanced prostate cancer, including enzalutamide, which is another androgen receptor blocker, and abiraterone, which inhibits the production of testosterone from the adrenal gland. And these were both found to be effective and prolonged survival. That essentially led to a paradigm shift in the way we think about prostate cancer. We then understood that prostate cancer still is responsive to androgen receptor signaling, and that by blocking that, we can get responses and improve survival. The only two drugs in that category that have been approved recently for that are, again, abiraterone, known as Zytiga, and enzalutamide, known as Xtandi. Both these drugs are well-tolerated. Rarely patients have symptoms that bother them enough that they want to either reduce the dose or stop, but most patients tolerate well and remain on that drug for varying periods of time. During the first 10 years of the decade from 2000 to 2010, there were several other drugs that were introduced that were shown to improve survival in patients with metastatic prostate cancer. I mentioned docetaxel, which is a chemotherapy drug. Another drug was approved a few years later called cabazitaxel, also known as Jevtana. That was approved in patients who had progressed through docetaxel and was shown to result in anti-tumor responses and prolongation of survival. Two other agents that work differently were also introduced during that time period. One is Provenge or Cipuleucel-T. This is an immunotherapy that in clinical trials improved survival compared to placebo. However, PSAs did not drop and no anti-tumor responses were seen. Provenge was approved for patients with small volume metastatic disease who are asymptomatic. The exact role for this agent is still to be determined, and many trials are currently underway looking at when is the best time to introduce that drug. My sense is that with any kind of immunotherapy, the best time to expect a response would be when there's small volume disease. Another drug that was introduced very recently is Zofigo, or alpha-radin, which is an injectable radioisotope. This radioisotope, radium-223, seeks out the bones and accumulates in areas where the bone is being attacked by the cancer. It delivers an alpha particle that either kills a cancer cell or the supporting cells for that cancer cell. That also has been shown to improve survival. Trials are underway now to see if that really helps with bone pain. But like many of the newer agents, PSA may not drop and objective responses may not be seen. Yet, as I mentioned above, survival was shown to be better. What else is going on that is novel that might be of interest to an audience like this? There were two trials reported in the past year. So far, all we have seen are abstracts, not the published paper. Both of them randomized patients with metastatic prostate cancer who were beginning androgen deprivation therapy to receive either androgen deprivation therapy alone or androgen deprivation with six cycles of docetaxel. The standard of care up until now has been that hormone therapy or anti-hormone therapy, androgen deprivation therapy, if you will, is the mainstay of treatment for this particular set of patients. And up until now, there's been no benefit shown for using chemotherapy early. However, two trials presented in abstract forms over the past year have now shown a very significant improvement in survival for adding chemotherapy to hormone therapy up front. Is that for everybody? The answer is no. The subset analysis suggests that it benefits most the patients who have large volume disease. And that is where we have been employing it, assuming that the patient is otherwise able to tolerate docetaxel. A word of caution here, very often data presented in abstract form as it matures turns out to be not quite as exciting as it initially appeared. So we are all anxiously awaiting publication of the peer-reviewed publication of trials addressing that issue. In the same sense, one trial was presented at ASCO this year for patients undergoing radiotherapy for high-risk prostate cancer. And again, the standard of care has been hormone therapy alone for those patients or anti-hormone therapy, androgen deprivation therapy, all the same thing. But this study showed a benefit for patients receiving chemotherapy with hormone therapy in this setting. Again, this is an abstract, and we are anxiously awaiting the results of the published trial. There's a lot of interest in immunotherapy. At this point, the only drug that has been tested is Provenj, or Cipuleucel-T. Newer agents are in trial, particularly those that unleash the immune system and allow it to attack the cancer cells more aggressively. But so far, we have no data. There are a number of new anti-androgens in the pipeline, and many studies are currently underway to determine what is the best sequence of deploying all those new drugs that I just told you about. We tend to use them in the sequence in which they became available to us, but there are many trials going on looking at what combinations of those drugs, what permutations of those drugs, and in what order should they be used. I want to say something about genomic testing, which everyone is reading about. So far, it is rare for genomic testing to result in a specific treatment for an individual patient, but that, of course, is the hope. So what we are seeing happen now more and more is that patients are asked to undergo biopsies. The importance of that is to get tissue to see what genes have changed that may be driving their individual cancer and find drugs to target them. I think the next few years are going to be very exciting, particularly in the field of immunotherapy and newer anti-androgens. Hopefully, the next time one of us reports back to you, we'll have even more exciting news to report. that ends my presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Campbell. That was really wonderful and very excellent, and thank you for that review of the treatment of from ASCO and from on prostate cancer. Thank you. And our next presenter will be speaking on brain cancer.
My pleasure now to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. Dr. Bruce is Edgar M. Husbian, Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman, Department of Neurosurgery, Columbia University College of Surgeons and Physicians, Co-Director, Brain Tumor Center, Director, Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory. And Dr. Bruce is going to address updates from ASCO on brain cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Bruce.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with everybody today. The recent ASCO meeting highlighted the fact that this is a great time for research and new developments in the areas of gliomas. Now, gliomas are tumors that begin in the brain. The most common glioma is a grade 4 glioblastoma, which is actually the fastest growing of the tumors. A grade 3 glioma is known as an anaplastic astrocytoma, and a grade 2 glioma is known as a low-grade glioma. The problem with lower-grade gliomas is that they have a tendency to eventually develop into higher-grade glioblastomas, where they cause a lot more problems. Now, the standard treatment for glioblastoma is to remove the tumor as completely as possible with surgery. Standard treatment then consists of 6 weeks of radiation therapy and chemotherapy with a drug called Temodar. And although treatment with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy can be effective, the tumors generally grow back at some point. And it's because of this tendency to grow back that there is a need for new treatments, many of which are of an experimental nature. And that's why these studies from the recent ASCO meeting are so important. There are a number of new treatments that were described in both tumors that were newly diagnosed, as well as some tumors that are recurrent, meaning tumors that have grown back after standard treatment. Now, among the most promising new treatments for newly diagnosed gliomas, and that is a tumor that's first being diagnosed without any treatment, is in the area of immunotherapy. And immunotherapy is a very exciting area, as it is really a strategy to help the body's own immune system to eliminate the tumor. And much of the immunotherapy work is still at a very early stage, but the early results are very promising. And there are a number of different types of immunotherapy treatments that are out there. Some are vaccines, some are giving antibodies, and some are just giving drugs that help boost the immune system. And I'm going to talk about a couple in particular that I thought were very interesting. One of the most interesting studies for the newly diagnosed glioblastoma patients came out of a multi-center trial, meaning a trial that was done at several institutions. And this one originated at Northwestern University in Chicago. And it used a special vaccine that is known as a heat shock protein peptide vaccine. You don't need to know the whole meaning of that other than to understand that this is a vaccine that is made by taking the patient's tumor out and processing in such a way that it creates a vaccine, and the vaccine is then injected back into the patient a few weeks later. Well, this vaccine was effective at improving the overall survival of patients who received it. And additionally, this study looked at a biomarker, that is something that could be measured in the bloodstream, that correlated with an immunological effect. In other words, by looking at testing some proteins in the blood, we could show that the vaccine was actually working. And this is exciting because this biomarker, which is called PD-L1, could potentially be an area where a drug could be used to make the vaccine even more effective. So it's helpful to be able to look at these different things that are going on in the bloodstream because it will lead to other developments that can make the vaccine even more effective. Now, another multicenter trial was a phase 2 study that looked at the use of gene therapy with the genes being delivered by a specially engineered virus that was then used in conjunction with another drug. So this is sort of a complicated treatment. But the way this works is the virus is given, and this virus produces a protein, and this protein is then inactivated is then activated by a drug. So the activated protein successfully kills the tumor cells. So the way this works is the virus is injected, the virus creates a protein, the protein is then activated by an outside drug, and this activated protein then kills the tumor cells. So in addition to improving the overall survival of the patients that were given this treatment also showed the value of getting a gross total of resection of the tumor with surgery prior to treatment. So it also showed that surgery can be a value in these kind of treatment strategies. Another interesting study was an international study that looked at what are called tumor treating fields, known as TTF. And this is a portable medical device that is attached to the patient's head to deliver electrical impulses that block cancer cells from growing and dividing. And this device is applied to a patient's head, and then it's turned on constantly for weeks at a time. It's got a battery power pack. Patients wear this special battery pack that allows them to walk around connected to this device, and the whole time they're getting this electric field to the head. This is a very innovative and interesting study that showed that there was some modest improvement in survival without any actual toxicity or decreased quality of life, meaning it was very safe. And this device was used along with Temodar, so patients got both Temodar and the device. Moving on to a study out of Johns Hopkins. This study was a retrospective study, meaning they looked at the results in retrospect, and showed that patients with grade 3 anaplastic astrocytomas could also benefit from Temodar and radiation. Previously, it was not clear if Temodar could be helpful to anaplastic, you know, grade 3 tumors. We knew Temodar worked for grade 4, but it wasn't clear whether it worked for grade 3. And this study showed that there was some benefit in using Temodar and radiation in the grade 3 tumors. Okay, moving on to patients with recurrent glioblastomas. There were two ASCO studies in particular that showed some potential benefits for patients with recurrent glioblastomas, meaning glioblastomas that have grown back after standard treatment with radiation and Temodar. Now, one multicenter trial came from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and it showed the benefit of an investigational vaccine that is made from what is known as the EGFR peptide mutation. So this EGFR peptide vaccine is injected into the skin along with a drug called GM-CSF. And the GM-CSF is a drug that boosts the entire immune system. So this combination of the EGFR mutation vaccine or the EGFR V3 vaccine given with GM-CSF produced a nice effect from the immune system that was effective at killing the tumor. And this vaccine in particular was given along with the drug Avastin. Avastin is an angiogenesis inhibitor that's used commonly for recurrent gliomas. And this combination of the vaccine, the GM-CSF, and the Avastin showed some modest benefit in prolonging survival. Now, additionally, a study out of Germany showed that patients that have recurrent glioblastomas would benefit from surgery if the surgeon is able to remove as much of the tumor as possible. So we already know that with newly diagnosed glioblastomas, if you remove them as completely as possible, that those patients do better. And this study from Germany showed that even patients with recurrent tumors, that is tumors that after they grow back, would benefit from surgery. Another area of research has to do with new diagnostic and prognostic tools using different biomarkers that can be measured either in the tumor or in some cases in the blood. And one of the most interesting biomarkers is called the IDH marker, which is shown in several studies to be a good prognostic marker for whether a patient will respond well to treatment. This is something that has been looked at in low-grade gliomas as well as high-grade gliomas. And you can look at IDH levels in the tumor itself. And in some cases, there's ways to look at it in the circulation. And patients with IDH1 mutations or abnormal IDH tend to have the best prognosis and the best response to treatment. And this is similar to patients that have the so-called 1P19Q codeletion, which you may have heard about. Well, These two biomarkers, IDH and 1P19Q, have been very well studied as a means of predicting prognosis. In addition, a group of investigators from Germany showed that the IDH1 status could potentially be seen with a PET scan, which means you could potentially use a scan to determine the prognosis of the patient without even having to have tumor tissue. The research with biomarkers is very exciting because it gets physicians closer to the idea of finding better individual treatments for patients. And in being able to look at each individual patient's biomarkers, we may eventually one day be able to individualize the treatment for them. I want to end by talking about some general advice for communicating with your healthcare team. It's important, first of all, to make sure that you find a specialist specifically in brain tumors. And the people who specialize in this area are in the best position to know the latest and best treatments available. Additionally, groups like Cancer Care are important because they provide support and information from those who are suffering with these tumors. It's important to communicate with your family and to be skeptical of anecdotes that may not have anything to do with the condition that you or your loved one has. It may also be useful to have a second opinion if time is available. Having someone else to discuss your case with you as a second opinion can provide some comfort and knowledge that you're doing the right thing. Finally, I want to end by saying there are some great laboratories and great researchers who are working on glioblastoma. The research being done now is more sophisticated than ever, and the optimism for finding better treatments and improving the quality of life has never been greater. Thank you all for listening.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was an outstanding presentation, very informative, and really I think everybody now feels a great deal of promise in terms of the treatments available for brain cancers and for the treatment of brain cancer. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Mizakowicz. And Dr. Mizakowicz is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology, Assistant Professor, Otolaryngology, Tisch Cancer Institute, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital. And Dr. Mizakowicz is going to address oral and head and neck cancer and updates from ASCO. I now turn the program over to Dr. Mizakowicz. Thank you.
So welcome to the Best of ASCO Annual Meeting 2015. I will be focusing on the head and neck cancer, and I can say that all of us, we can conclude that immunotherapy dominated this year ASCO and got most of that attention, including the head and neck cancer. Among many posters that were presented, trials in development, and I strongly encourage our patients to participate in those with PD-1 and PD-1 inhibitors. There is one exciting study. It's called KEYNOTE-012 Expansion Cohort that was presented by a group from Chicago and reported on anti-tumor activity of the anti-PD-1 antibody called pembrolizumab in patients with recurrent and metastatic squamous cell carcinoma of head and neck. Pembrolizumab is an IgG4 antibody and that has no ADC activity, which is an antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity, but exerts a dual ligand blockage of PD-L1 and PD-L2, which is very important for us physicians. They had 132 patients that were heavily pretreated, so even though they received subsequent lines of treatment, they still were eligible on this study. And what is important that PD-L1 status was not mandatory in this study. The entire group received a medication called pembrolizumab at the dose of 200 milligrams. It was a flat dose that was given every 3 weeks intravenously. What was really surprising and to the benefit of the patients that the treatment was very well tolerated. There were absolutely no deaths related to the treatment, and only 10% of the patients, they have grade 3 to 5, which is the higher grade of toxicity, but it was mainly the facial swelling and pneumonitis, which is the inflammation of the lung. Other side effects that were seen on the trial, there were fatigue, hypothyroidism, which is a low thyroid, decreased appetite, rash, arthralgia, which is a bone pain, nausea, and weight loss, but all of them are very manageable. The overall response rate for the entire population was very encouraging, and we all got excited about this. And the response rate was seen in the HPV positive as well as HPV negative patients. And interestingly, the HPV negative patients, they had slightly better response rate. What's really interesting that also patients have stable disease, that is very important as we follow our patients. median time to response, which is how long we have to wait until the drug becomes efficacious and can address our cancer, was about 9 weeks, and the response rate seemed to be very durable. Something that has to be obviously noted that we have to focus our effort on maximizing the dose and the schedule as we talk about this treatment, because unfortunately they become very expensive. So what we have to do as we're going to develop subsequent study, we have to develop what's the best way to dose the treatment, if it's the every 3 weeks, every 2 weeks, maximize the dose. If the higher dose, it really translates into the better outcome. And what we have to do some studies that are going to enrich the population that's going to be eligible for the studies, meaning that we're going to develop some biomarkers that are going to guide the physician which patient should participate in those studies and eventually subsequently get the treatment. Something that's going to be important, I think, going to the future, that immunotherapy will become the backbone of the treatment, and other treatment modalities probably will be added to this, such as chemotherapy and targeted therapy, and some of them unfortunately comes at a significant cost, and obviously we have to be aware of this and to make sure that not only we're going to be focusing on the clinical outcome at the cost of those treatments, because we don't want to reach the stage in which the treatment will be prohibitive. I just want to move to the de-escalation. This is the very popular term in head and neck cancer patients because, as we know, the HPV-positive patients, they have significantly better outcome than HPV-negative patients, and there is a tremendous effort on developing the new treatment strategies in which patients with the HPV-positive status would receive less treatment and not compromising on its efficacy. So one study that was presented by Dr. Cheria, it was a prospective study. Patients received lower dose of radiation. It was 6 weeks instead of 7 weeks, and patients received 60 gray. In addition, the chemotherapy that was used, cisplatin, was given at the lower dose. It was given weekly at 30 milligrams per meter square. Patients after the therapy were evaluated for the response and had to undergo the biopsy of the primary mass, and they received the surgery that is called the lymph node dissection, in which they removed all lymph nodes that pre-surgically were evaluated as a possibly carrying the cancer. And the results were very, very encouraging, meaning that their treatment was very efficacious. So the overall conclusion was that the treatment was very effective. We have to be aware that obviously this study has some limitations, such as small sample size and short follow-up, and obviously we have to have the largest study to confirm those encouraging results. Something that has to be pointed out, that a lymph node dissection, which is a surgery that was done and was mandatory, was informative because it told us how effective the treatment was. We think that currently, especially with the other trials that were presented at ASCO, I think the lymph node dissection can be replaced with the PET scan, which is a radiographic study to assess the response after the treatment is given. So I think going in forward in the future, I don't think that we're going to see as many surgeries after the definitive treatment. I think we're going to be using a radiographic study such as PET scan to evaluate the efficacy of our treatment. At the same time, in the same panel, there is another interesting study presented by Dr. D'Souza that evaluated the prognostic implication of persistent HPV-16 DNA detection in oral rinses. So patients with the oropharyngeal cancer were asked to rinse the mouth and spit it on the cup so we can measure how much HPV-16 DNA they have inside. They have 124 patients with history of oropharyngeal cancer that subsequently were treated with curative intent, and they were followed up. Patients, they have to rinse their mouth and give us the specimens at 9, 12, 18, and 24 months. And 50% of them, they had HPV-16 that is well known in this population, and 22% they had other HPV viruses. All of them, they had excellent response. All of them, they were free of disease after 2 years. But what was interesting, that post-treatment HPV-16 infection was seen in a small number of those patients, and if it was persistent, unfortunately, some of them they develop recurrence, and obviously it raises a question whether this persistent disease is truly a persistent infection or whether it is a reinfection or re-exposure to the HPV virus. And second, whether the oral rinse detection really represents the infection or integrated viral DNA that represents the tumor. And I think all this information has to be validated by examining the partners, sexual partners of those patients, but also correlated with the biomarker, and eventually down the line can change into the practice changing paradigm in which patients with persistent HPV 16 oral detection method that's going to detect the presence of the persistent infection may lead to the different treatments. Another interesting poster that was presented, it was presented by Dr. Lee on the role of undetectable plasma Epstein-Barr virus DNA. This is the virus that is associated with nasopharyngeal cancer. And what we do with those patients currently after the treatment, we just follow them up with the radiographic studies. This poster shows that among 200 patients in which the undetectable plasma EBV, Epstein-Barr virus DNA, showed difference in distant metastases and survival, meaning that after curative treatment, patient can undergo the blood test that will tell us whether there is a risk of developing distant metastases and recurrence of the disease. And I think it's very important because it can tell us if there is any role of giving chemotherapy after definitive treatment, but also what is really important, how to surveillance those patients, and especially because we do know that some of those patients, they may develop late recurrences. And instead of subjecting them to the PET scan or CAT scan over the long period of time, I think we can use this test, which is coming from the blood, to kind of detect whether the cancer is back or not. Another interesting question was asked during the ASCO sessions. Patients currently are being treated for head and neck cancer with chemotherapy and radiation. Usually the drug of choice is cisplatin, and we don't know how to give it, whether we should give it in the high dose that it's spread it every 3 weeks, or we should give it in the low dose on the weekly regimen. And there are some assumptions that maybe weekly cisplatin is better tolerated and maybe it's more efficacious, and this what led to this project. So what we do know that this study showed that what really matters is the total dose of the medication rather than the schedule. So currently, I think, in my opinion, it's not about how the cisplatin is given, whether it's weekly or it's every 3 weeks, but we have to make sure that the patient's total dose is not being compromised, because eventually it can translate into the clinical outcome. Another interesting study was done by the RTOG in which they analyzed three studies showing that age played a significant role as we're going to treat our patients in addition to smoking history as well as the P16 status. So as we're going to move forward, I think we should develop the elderly-specific clinical trials of stratification based on the age so we can treat our elderly population much better. I think overall the ASCO meeting was very exciting, and I'm looking forward to see more results on the immunotherapy, but I would strongly encourage our patients to participate on those clinical trials that are available across the country. Thank you very much for your attention. It was a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Misakawa. It was a wonderful presentation, very informative, and wonderfully informative for everybody, so thank you very much. And our final speaker for this program, a wonderful speaker, is Dr. Suzanne George. Dr. George is Clinical Director, Senior Physician, Center for Sarcoma and Bone Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor in Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. George is going to present to you on sarcoma and updates from ASCO on sarcoma. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. George.
Well, thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on sarcoma from the recent presentations at ASCO this year. This year marked a really busy year in the sarcoma community at ASCO, and it was apparent as the rooms where the oral sessions were held for sarcoma, both the primary and overflow rooms were full with attendees and had people standing around the edges as several trials that were highly anticipated were presented this year. There were three phase three trials presented and one randomized phase two trial presented, which summed up several trials which have been ongoing for the past 3 to 4 years. These look not only at new drugs, but also ways to better understand the current drugs that are available. In diseases like sarcoma, which are not common, it is indeed a unique year when so many randomized trials are presented, and I think that that's what really brought enthusiasm to the sarcoma community at this year's meeting. So I'd like to summarize these trials now. In the UK, Dr. Seddon and her colleagues performed a large phase three trial comparing two of the most commonly used chemotherapy regimens in patients with advanced sarcoma. These regimens are doxorubicin when given as a single agent, and also gemcitabine and docetaxel when given in combination. Although both clearly are active regimens in sarcoma, it has not been clear over the years if there is a best first choice between these two options. So Dr. Seddon and her team enrolled over 250 patients with advanced soft tissue sarcoma in a 3-year period. The trial was very informative and that it confirmed that both regimens indeed have activity in soft tissue sarcomas, and they were actually found to be very similar with regard to disease activity. Interestingly, when they looked at subgroups, meaning different types of sarcoma within the overall trial, there was no significant difference between the regimens, even in the, as we looked into different subtypes. The study did, however, show that the combination of gemcitabine and docetaxel in general had more side effects when compared to doxorubicin alone. Because of this, the investigative team recommended that doxorubicin should remain the first-line standard of care for all subtypes of soft tissue sarcoma. But in the associated discussion, Dr. Benjamin came to somewhat of an alternate conclusion, which was that gemcitabine and docetaxel could be considered a new first-line standard because it was indeed so similar to doxorubicin with regard to its effectiveness. I think the important issue shown in this study is that both regimens are indeed active in disease control in sarcomas, but that they bring with them different side effects. The optimal choice in the first-line setting is likely best tailored to the individual patient and the patient and doctor together based on the patient, the individual clinical situation, as well as the potential side effects. It is good news that both regimens had similar activity, suggesting that there are indeed options for patients, and it is likely that patients may indeed have treatment with both regimens at some point in the disease course. The next phase three trial that was presented by Dr. Shofsky, and he presented a study that compared eribulin, a chemotherapy that's currently approved for patients with advanced breast cancer, to the control arm called, which is dacarbazine or DTIC. DTIC is a long-time standard treatment in sarcoma and therefore was chosen as the control arm in this study. Now, the background was that this particular agent, eribulin, had previously been explored in a phase two trial in several subtypes of sarcoma. In that trial, the two most common subtypes, liposarcoma and leiomyosarcoma, appeared to be sensitive to eribulin. Patients enrolled in the current phase three trial were required, therefore, to have either liposarcoma or leiomyosarcoma and were randomly assigned to either eribulin or dacarbazine. The study team found that eribulin appeared to be superior to dacarbazine, and this seemed most notable in patients with the liposarcoma type of tumor. The drug is currently being reviewed by the FDA, the U.S. FDA, to determine if it will ultimately be approved for the management of soft tissue sarcoma. The results of another large multi-center randomized phase 3 trial were presented by Dr. Dimitri. In this study, the drug trabectedin was also compared to the standard arm DTIC. In this trial, again, over 500 patients with leiomyosarcoma or liposarcoma were randomly assigned to either trabectedin or dacarbazine. Patients were then followed to see how long their tumors were under control. Similar to the eribulin study, previous research had suggested that these two subtypes, liposarcoma and leiomyosarcoma, were the most sensitive types of sarcoma to trabectedin. In the current phase 3 trial, the majority of patients actually had leiomyosarcoma, and the results demonstrated a benefit in the trabectedin arm compared to dacarbazine. Trabectedin, which works by binding the minor groove of DNA and thereby interrupting cell division, is currently approved in Europe and many other countries worldwide for the treatment of soft tissue sarcoma, and based on the results of the phase 3 trial presented this year, is now being reviewed by the FDA in the U.S. for consideration of approval here. There is an ongoing access trial at a number of U.S. sites for patients who may benefit from trabectedin prior to the final decision of the FDA. It is important to note that in both of these randomized trials, although the investigational arm showed improvement when compared to dacarbazine, dacarbazine did indeed have activity for some patients and can remain an option for care for these patients. Another interesting study was presented by Dr. Tapp. This was the results of a randomized phase 1b/2 trial of olaratumab plus doxorubicin compared to doxorubicin alone. Olaratumab is an antibody directed against platelet-derived growth factor receptor alpha. Platelet-derived growth factor receptor alpha is a protein which is present on some sarcomas, but also is present in the cells of the cancer environment, or the stroma. In the current study, 129 patients were randomly assigned to either doxorubicin alone or doxorubicin plus olaratumab. Patients assigned to the olaratumab group would remain on the olaratumab after doxorubicin was complete. The investigators reported that there was a significant advantage to the olaratumab combination arm. The exact reason as to why the combination was actually better is not well understood, but the results were so promising that there is a new study being developed which will further evaluate this intriguing compound in combination with chemotherapy in soft tissue sarcomas. In addition to these large randomized trials, several smaller phase 2 trials presented promising data in sarcoma. These included a phase 2 study of regorafenib, which is a multi-targeted kinase inhibitor, in subtypes of sarcoma, and early results suggest that there may be some benefit in leiomyosarcoma and other sarcoma subtypes. There was also early data looking at HDAC inhibition, which is a novel approach in this disease type, as well as newer tyrosine kinase inhibitors and novel combinations. From this ASCO, it was exciting to know that these unique compounds are being explored in soft tissue and bone tumors. There also was new data presented in gastrointestinal stromal tumor, or GIST, and most notably this came in the form of an update from the Scandinavian Sarcoma Group, which presented long-term data on the adjuvant trial known as SSG13. In this study, patients with high-risk GIST were randomized to take either 1 year of imatinib following surgery or 3 years of imatinib following surgery. The initial study was presented several years ago and demonstrated benefit to the 3-year arm, and the current analysis continues to show this strong benefit for 3 years of treatment. It also highlights the need for ongoing investigations to further evaluate whether even longer duration may be beneficial. Pazopanib is another tyrosine kinase inhibitor that was shown to have some benefit in patients with GIST. And interestingly, the French team that did this study presented an interesting observation, which was that patients who had undergone significant prior surgery on their stomach had much less benefit when compared to patients who had not undergone such surgery. And this interesting observation may well reflect the importance of stomach digestion on the activity of pazopanib, an observation that has previously been noted in other cancer types. Lastly, there were quite a few early studies evaluating circulating free tumor DNA in the blood of patients with GIST. In GIST, we know that mutations in a protein called KIT is a critical factor to tumor growth. And we also know that many different mutations can be found within patients with GIST, and it may well not be practical to perform biopsies on all patients in order to gain an understanding of the extent of the mutations present. Therefore, teams are interested to see if these mutations in tumor DNA can be identified in the blood. We are learning that this is indeed possible. However, we are also learning that different techniques can be more or less successful at identifying this mutational landscape. And as we look toward the future, the ability to do a reliable liquid biopsy is becoming more and more possible. Overall, this was an exciting year in sarcoma, with the presentation of several multi-year phase 3 trials that have led to ongoing FDA review of possible new drugs in this disease type, together with earlier studies suggesting additional promising agents on the horizon. This is a reflection of many of the new and exciting activities at ASCO this year across many different tumor types. I think we will all look forward to continuing to see novel agents, novel diagnostics, and immunotherapies continue to be explored in the cancer field. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. George. That was really outstanding and really amazing. And novel interventions for people living with sarcoma. And then your comment, most importantly as well, about the fact that many of these innovations and many of the reports at ASCO are reflective of just tremendous development in the field in general, and how that's coming across many tumor types. So to stay tuned for everybody. I want to thank everyone for participating in this really on today's workshop, today's Cancer Connect workshop. You're a very large group, and you are a very excited group to be listening in today. I do want to remind you that today's program was an hour and a half, and many of you are listening to get a lot of information about many different types of cancers. There will be a part two to this on Tuesday, June 16th. Many of you have signed up for that as well. I do want to remind all of you that this is, although the workshop is soon to end, that the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are continuous. And I do want to give you two resources to call, because some of you may have some medical questions that you'd like to have answered. Some, perhaps as you listened, you had some issues or questions you wanted to ask just in terms of yourself or in terms of the work you're doing. So I do recommend for any medical questions that you call the National Cancer Institute. Their information specialists are always on standby after our programs, and they're on standby all the time anyway. And their number is 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237 for any of your questions that really have to do with these reports from ASCO and any of the information that you'd like to get further information about. In addition, some of you may also have some quality of life. It's like a social concerns about just practical matters or your emotional and social issues or just wanting someone to talk to. We have at Cancer Care a staff of oncology social workers who offer a full range of services that are free from practical and financial assistance to all types of counseling services and a range of support groups from telephone support groups and online support groups. So really, for all of you, that's very accessible. And we also are here just really to be available to talk with you. We do have programs for people at different points in the life cycle and also for children and teens. So really, we our services cover the entire spectrum from children and teens to young adults, to middle-aged adults and older adults, really the whole life cycle. We have staff to help with all your issues and concerns and questions that you might have. For those questions, I would recommend that you call Cancer Care, and the number that you would call at Cancer Care be 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I know that it is often tempting for many of you living with cancer to think that you're alone, that there really isn't anyone there for you, and I want you to now know that you are part of the umbrella of the Cancer Care family. Do take advantage of our services, and also if you have medical questions, do contact the National Cancer Institute as well. I want to thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I'll see you all in part two of this program next Tuesday. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude the workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.